Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So, a great show ahead of us tonight. In studio with me, Niall Hatch. We'll be joined by Terry Flanagan shortly, telling us about some very special specimens in the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. And later, we'll hear from Richard Collins and an interview he conducted with our fisheries scientist, Ken Whelan, about the plight of salmon in Irish and British waters and indeed further afield. But anyway, more about that anon. But first of all, I want to tell you about a documentary we have here as part of our Nature on One series next Monday at 3 p.m.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I'd go with chicken.
Why?
Because the egg had to come from somewhere, so it came from the chicken.
Had to be the chicken, yeah.
Why?
Because you couldn't get an egg without a chicken.
But you couldn't get a chicken without an egg, but you couldn't get an egg without a chicken.
This holiday Monday, ornithologist Niall Hatch explores the wonderful world of birds' eggs.
There must be two chickens.
The secret behind the shell of a bird's egg is that it's full of tiny holes, which allow the developing chick within to breathe oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide.
That's Nature on One, Monday at 3 o'clock on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio app.
Well, I certainly hope that's whet your appetite for a wonderful documentary about birds' eggs next Monday afternoon, presented by Niall Hatch. Niall!
Yes, it's all about a favourite topic of mine and an object that has been described very memorably as perhaps the most perfect thing in the universe. So how about that for a build-up? It's about birds' eggs.
Mm.
I've been fascinated by birds all of my life, as you know, Derek, and I'm well aware that of all of the hundreds of billions of birds on Earth at the moment, every single one of those started life inside an egg. It had to hatch out of that and then develop from there. And for years, I've been fascinated by how eggs are produced, how they're such wonderfully self-contained reproductive units for these birds. Because unlike placental mammals, such as we humans, the females of our species carry their offspring around inside their bodies, the embryos at least, for the first 9 months of their existence. Well, birds are different. They lay their eggs and those embryos then develop outside of the body. You know, for this documentary, we asked quite a few people, what's an egg? Where do eggs come from? Those sort of questions. And it's very interesting to me because the majority of animals in the world lay eggs. If you think about insects, fish, frogs, so many different species do this. Even a few mammals, the duck-billed platypus in Australia is a great example of that too. But almost everybody comes back and they say one of two things. They may say birds,
mm-hmm.
or even more commonly, they say chickens. And it is quite interesting. That's one of the main thrusts of this. I wanted to sort of explore, how did birds' eggs evolve? They're quite a unique thing. The thing that sets birds' eggs apart from all other eggs, all the other ones that I mentioned, from all these other creatures on the planet, birds have hard-shelled eggs that are pointed at one end and rounded at the other, and they have porous shells that actually allow the embryo inside to breathe. They can actually take in oxygen, take out carbon dioxide all the time while being inside a waterproof, protective, hard container, which is really unique in the world. There aren't any other animals in the world that have that arrangement. So that's what's unique about birds' eggs. But we may hear in the documentary that perhaps that didn't start with birds. Maybe someone else came before either the chicken
dun,
or the egg.
Dun, dun. Well, now I know a little bit about birds' eggs, not very much because I used to watch, as you know, the Blue Tits
yes.
in my back garden, and we used to stream it live. And before that, we had Jackie and Daw, the pair of jackdaws that had nested in County Kildare.
That's right.
And we were looking at those birds and how they minded and cared for the eggs. And I remember about the Blue Tits in particular, how many they laid, given that the bird is so small, because they can lay up to 16 eggs, as I understand it. And the bird's only, what, weighs about 11 grams or something?
Yeah, absolutely. And each of those eggs weighs about a gram. So if you think about that, over the course of that, just that one breeding season, the female is laying more than her own body weight in eggs, which is quite remarkable. And inside those eggs, you have the yellow part, the yolk. You have the albumen, the white part of the egg. You have all sorts of other things too, but they're the main parts in there. That's very nutritious. It's there to protect and feed the growing embryo inside. Well, the only place that nutrition can come from is from within the mother's own body. Her own food reserves provide those. Eggs come in a hard shell. It's made of a substance called calcium carbonate, the same stuff as chalk and limestone, the same stuff as snail shells as well. the bird has to have that in her body to be able to produce those eggshells. So if you think the physical toll and the requirements on that female's body to lay those eggs, why would she do that? It must take a big toll on her. But her whole purpose in life is to pass on her genes to the next generation. And that's how you do it. And birds will lay the optimum number of eggs for that kind of survival to match the amount of food and other resources that are around. So some birds, a lot of seabirds, for example, and birds like swifts as well, they may lay just one egg, but they invest a lot of time and attention into that egg. Whereas with other birds, they have a bit more of an attrition rate. They're not expecting that all, or at least evolution hasn't provided for all of those chicks to survive. Just the very fittest will. But if there's a boom year and you have lots of food around, well, more of those chicks on average will survive, and then more of the genes will be passed on to next generation.
So it's all to do with resources.
It's all to do with resources.
Internal and external.
Precisely, absolutely. The way that birds do it is very different to the way that humans do it. So because they're not carrying these eggs around in their bodies, birds don't become pregnant in the same way that a human or another mammal might do. Because of that, they can actually diversify a bit more, and they can mean that they don't have to carry them around with them. But it also has some other downsides. It means that they can't warm them inside their own bodies the way that most mammals can. We don't have to worry about, or mothers don't have to worry about keeping the embryo warm. The body does that automatically. The birds can't do that. So then, of course, they have to incubate those eggs.
Yeah, I was going to say, they do have to do it, although they're not doing it internally. They are doing it externally.
Absolutely.
So they sit on them. That's why they've got a brood patch, isn't it?
It is. That's the bare patch of skin, basically the bald spot on the belly of the bird. They lose a patch of feathers there that allows direct skin on eggshell contact. And I remember, Derek, when we were looking at the blue tits in your back garden, there was a nationwide phenomenon. People really got into it. And a lot of people are very excited to see that it's not just the case that the blue tit or any other bird is just sitting on those eggs doing nothing. They're getting up all the time. They're turning them around. They're putting the ones on the top down at the bottom to rotate them, move them around to make sure that heat is evenly distributed. And the bird somehow knows how to do that intrinsically. It knows to do that. If it didn't move those eggs around, there'd be a risk of the ones at the top maybe overheating, the ones on the bottom chilling. The embryos wouldn't develop properly, even if at all. And we also know that birds have a higher body temperature than we humans do. They're about 40 degrees Celsius. At that temperature, we'd be dead. So within the birds, though, we know that that's too hot for an embryo to develop. So they have to have them outside the body. It's fascinating stuff. I learned so much researching
this. Well, now, can I ask you a question?
Of course you can, Derek.
I'm thinking now of crocodilians.
Yes. Crocodilians, yeah, the closest living relatives of birds.
Yeah. Now, they lay eggs.
Yes.
And they make a mound and they put all sorts of vegetation over the eggs, and they lay on the vegetation over the eggs, and they can control the temperature of the nest in there by doing that. They're not laying directly on the eggs. Am I right?
That's absolutely
okay.
Right.
And they can determine the sex of the offspring, as I understand it, by controlling the temperature. So if it's 32 degrees, it might be a male, or if it's 34 degrees, it might be a female. I'm not sure those figures are accurate, but you get what I'm saying. Now, given that they're such close relatives, I'm wondering, is there any bird in the world that does something similar?
No.
Okay.
We know that, as is the case with mammals, that seems to be fixed at the moment of conception. So it's all about chromosomes and that sort of genetic exchange. It's not governed by the temperature. With many crocodilians and with the crocodilians and many other reptiles as well, however it is. And actually, that's one of the challenges when it comes to conservation in an era of climate change. One of the problems that many reptile species may face, or indeed are already facing, another example would be sea turtles. They have exactly the same arrangement. It means that because the temperature is rising, you have too many of one gender being produced. And then that leads to skewing of the population. And eventually it'll mean, essentially, it could mean complete collapse. So they're already looking with some of these reptiles that perhaps artificial incubation may be the only way forward for some of them, at least for now, because the breeding colony areas, the nesting areas are too warm. And that's something that's just going to get worse and worse. Birds at least don't have to face that challenge. Climate change has many other problems for them, but at least it doesn't affect the sex of their offspring.
But is there not one bird out there that doesn't incubate its own eggs?
Yes.
In the traditional sense, by laying the eggs and then incubating them by putting its body on top of them and forming that brood patch.
Yes, there's a family of birds called the megapodes, which are found in the Australasian region. The best known is probably a bird called the mallee fowl, which is found in Australia. Sometimes called the brush turkey, not related to true turkeys though at all.
Or brushes
indeed. and what they do is quite similar to what the crocodiles do. What they do is the eggs are laid by the female, of course. The male constructs a mound of vegetation over the top of them, sometimes quite a big heap of vegetation. And what happens is that vegetation then starts to decompose. And as it decomposes, as any anyone who has a compost heap in their garden
gets
will
very
know
warm.
Gets very warm. And that's the heat then that is used to warm those eggs and to start those embryos developing. But it's not that the male, because in this case it's just the male that cares for these eggs, it's not that he can just walk away and leave it, because that's too random. Weather will change. Vegetation may decay at different rates. It could get too hot, could get too cool. Mm. So what he does is he monitors this all the time, and he will then remove or add pieces of vegetation to control perfectly the temperature.
But he won't incubate.
No, he doesn't incubate with his own
body. But the crocodile does.
Yeah, crocodile does, yes.
Now back to my blue tits.
Yes.
We were saying that they can lay up to 16 eggs, and the eggs are tiny, and the bird is tiny, but it's not the smallest bird in the world. I think that honour and glory goes to the hummingbirds, if I'm not mistaken.
The bee hummingbird of Cuba is the tiniest, yeah.
But does the bee hummingbird of Cuba then lay the smallest egg in the world? Did you talk to anybody about big and small eggs?
I did for this documentary. I had a great conversation with Eric Dempsey. It was absolutely fantastic. What better man to have a discussion with? Eric and I would be chatting about this stuff anyway, even if we weren't recording it. But I figured, why not? It was great to have it. So the bee hummingbird of Cuba is the smallest bird in the world, and it almost lays the smallest egg. Its egg is absolutely tiny, but it is just beaten by the second smallest bird in the world, a close relative called the vervain hummingbird. And the vervain hummingbird is found only in Jamaica and on the island of Hispaniola. So the vervain hummingbird of Jamaica, Dominican Republic and Haiti, it lays the smallest egg in the world of any bird. However, proportionately, it's still a pretty big egg for that bird, because the bird is tiny and the egg, you've got to remember, it has to contain the yolk, it has to contain all the albumin, the white, and then it has to contain that growing embryo. The egg is about a centimetre in length, 10 millimetres, you know, so very, very small. But for the size of the bird, it's still quite a big egg. You then go to the biggest bird in the world living today, which would be the ostrich, which lays the biggest egg. It's absolutely massive. But compared to the size of the body, it's actually one of the smallest birds proportionate to the bird that laid it.
Oh, my goodness.
It's just a whole big discussion that Eric and I had. And then we finally settled on what actually is...
Oh, don't tell us.
I won't, but what is perhaps the most impressive bird? There is one bird in the world where the poor female has to lay an egg that's up to around a quarter of her own body weight.
Oh, wow.
And so that's pretty serious.
Painful, I would have thought.
So if you tune into the documentary to find out who that is.
Okay, now I want to mention at this point the guillemot, Niall. So the guillemot, will you describe what a guillemot looks like, where we can find it?
So every summer in Birdwatch Ireland and here at Mooney Goes Wild, we are inundated with people reporting sightings of penguins around the Irish coast. Mm. They'll say, there's a penguin at the beach in Bray, or there's a penguin off Salt Hill Strand. And is that unusual? And the fact is, it's not a penguin. It's almost always a guillemot, a very penguin-like bird, a member of the auk family, which includes the puffin. That's probably the most famous auk. Guillemots nest in big colonies on sea cliffs all around the North Atlantic, including here in Ireland. And they do look very like penguins. They are dark brown / black above, white below, as are many seabirds. They have that upright stance with a waddle just like a penguin. But unlike penguins, they can fly, and they can fly up to the breeding ledges to nest. And in these colonies, that you can have tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of pairs of these guillemots all side by side, densely packed in on these narrow little breeding ledges. So all of these thousands of eggs, how can the parent birds tell them apart? Well, what's actually happened there is that the guillemot has developed perhaps the most complex array of egg coloration of any bird in the world. They look so different from each other. You wouldn't think that the same species had laid them, at least based on colour. But what you'll also hear in the documentary, when we talk to Tim Burkhead, a leading expert ornithologist on birds' eggs, he describes how the actual shape of the guillemot egg is very distinctive, and that's how you tell them apart. It was long believed, and you'll hear so many bird watchers still saying this, that the pear-shaped, very elongated, pointed shape of the guillemot egg is so that it won't roll off the breeding ledge. It'll just go around in a circle if knocked. Now, it turns out that's absolutely untrue. That's not the case at all. Those ledges are so narrow, it would still easily fall off. However, it does allow more of the egg to contact the surface of that ledge, increasing the friction, which prevents or reduces the likelihood of it actually rolling in the first place.
Now, he wrote a book about eggs.
He did, called The Most Perfect Thing. And it's a phenomenal book. I would definitely recommend it to anybody who wants to take their interest in birds' eggs further. It explains everything so well.
We had him on Mooney Goes Wild some years ago, and we have a clip of him explaining why he actually wrote the book, which is related to the spinning, or the belief that this egg, the guillemot egg, was shaped such that it wouldn't spin off the ledge. Have a listen.
I was watching a wildlife television programme, and the presenter, much loved and respected presenter, gave this spinning like a top explanation for the guillemot's egg shape. And that, as I say, that spinning like a top explanation had been dismissed 100 years ago. So I was a bit shocked. And as somebody who's been preoccupied with educating students, the idea that somebody on television, incredibly influential, could misinform the public kind of touched a nerve with me. And it made me think, well, actually, nobody's really looked at why guillemot eggs are this shape. So I started to look again. And the key study was published originally in German with a very brief English summary. And people had used that English summary. So I paid a German-speaking colleague in the university here to translate the whole paper. It was a nightmare because it was a huge paper and it cost a fortune. But it revealed that the experiments that had been conducted by this Swiss ethologist, Beat Chans, and his colleagues, were not quite as robust as the summary statement seemed to imply. And it made me realise that here was a research opportunity. We could start to look at this seriously in a bit more detail and with the benefit of many, many more years of kind of knowledge and methodology and so on. So that was the starting point. If you're going to do that, you have to know a lot about eggs. So I started to read widely about eggs. And then I kind of realised that nobody had ever written about eggs from a biological perspective. And there was a good reason for that. The idea of people collecting eggs, for most of us, is anathema. So basically, the topic of eggs was what I call the forbidden area of ornithology. So some conservation organisations won't even publish a photograph of an egg or a bird's nest because they're so terrified that this might cause a resurgence of egg collecting, which it won't, of course. And in fact, when I wrote my book, part of my motivation was to try to break through this kind of cultural roadblock that said you don't study eggs. So there is a huge resistance to eggs. And really my motivation was to show people that eggs were wonderful, the most perfect thing, fascinating, worthy of study, lots of questions still remaining to be answered. And so that was the motivation for writing that book. The reason for focusing to some extent on guillemots is that I've studied guillemots since the 1970s. I'm passionately involved in guillemots, and they have the most extreme form of egg and coloration of egg of any species, certainly in Britain. And so it was a perfect combination of those two things working together.
Tim Burkhead's explanation for why guillemot eggs are shaped the way they are will be revealed in the documentary next Monday, right here on RTE Radio 1. Niall, were you one of those people telling others that that was the reason why the guillemot egg was shaped the way it was, so it wouldn't roll off the ledge?
Up until I read Tim's book, yes, that was the widely held belief, and he's completely blown that out of the water and proven the real reason why the eggs are that shape. And there's a couple of reasons, actually. You'll hear more in the documentary. But yes, they are that shape because of the nesting conditions of those birds and because they're on the ledges, but it's not to stop them
rolling off. Who is the BBC wildlife presenter? That's what we want to know. He wouldn't say the name.
No, I'm afraid we don't have that exclusive during the documentary.
All right, anyway. Listen, let's say hello now to Terence Flanagan. By the way, you can hear that documentary, Nature on One special, Birds, Eggs, next Monday afternoon. It's the bank holiday. Fantastic time to listen to the radio and especially nature programmes at 3 p.m. presented by Niall Hatch. Let's say hello to Terry Flanagan now at his home in Dublin 15. Terry, you were working on that programme as well, were you not? You were down in Photo Wildlife Park recently looking at curlews and incubation.
I was indeed. And speaking of incubation, I used to incubate eggs myself, Derek. I never told you that. But years ago in school, particularly with transition years, one of the projects we used to do was we used to incubate eggs. I found it fascinating at the time because there's a fair bit to it. It's not just as simple as getting an incubator and throwing a few eggs in it and leaving it there for a couple of weeks.
No.
You have to look after the eggs. It's a bit like the mammy bird does. You have to turn the eggs every day, but twice a day. You have to spray them to keep it nice and humid. But it's really great when they hatch out. Now, what I was actually hatching out were pheasant eggs. And the reason why I was hatching those pheasant eggs, because there were eggs that had been abandoned in a local estate beside me because there had been a lot of pheasants there. And if the adult pheasants had been disturbed and that, I was giving them a bit of a handout by taking them and then incubating them and doing it in school. So, yeah, it was really, really interesting.
It's interesting to me, Terry, that quite a few people think that if they get chicken's eggs from the supermarket and put them in some sort of incubator or under a heat lamp or something like that, that they're going to hatch out. Now, in the vast majority of cases, that is not going to happen because those eggs have not been fertilised. You need to have the rooster around in order to do that. Chickens have been bred so that the females will lay eggs even though those eggs haven't been fertilised and they haven't mated, which is quite unusual in the bird world. So is that something you've ever come across anyone trying?
No, I've never ever come across it. As I said, it was only just a small little project we were doing. We were just hatching out these eggs. And the reason why we were doing it then is that we were bringing the young birds back up to the estate for them to be released again. So it was just something. And you know what? I enjoyed it, particularly for the kids' sake in school. It was one of those things that they never ever got to see. You know, Dublin kids don't get to see these things. But the kids in Moyle Park, well, they got to see it.
Well, I went to school back in the 70s and the 80s and we had an incubator in school and I saw it myself. So a lot of people would have seen it and I'm a dog, Terrence.
What did you incubate?
Eggs. I don't know what kind of eggs they were.
Warm your sandwiches, was it, at lunch?
I don't know, they were eggs. I don't know what kind of eggs they were, but we did do it, yeah.
Never came across any other science teacher who was ever doing it. So, well, you know, maybe I didn't look hard enough, but it was just something small, something we did and that the kids really got to enjoy because it's part of biology. It's part of life.
And just to stress as well that people shouldn't go out to birds' nests in their garden, take eggs and then incubate them. It would be illegal and in most cases it's not going to work anyway. But so please don't do that. But you can get these things commercially. There are many people who have chickens and are fertilised eggs and it's possible to do that. But Terry, I know that when you were doing it, you mentioned that there's more to it than meets the eye or than people would assume. I was talking earlier to Derek about the blue tits that were in his back garden and the famous nest watch that we did a few years back and how active the parents were, not just in sitting on the eggs, but in turning them over and putting the ones from the top down to the bottom and so on to make sure that the heat was evenly distributed. That's a really crucial part of it, isn't it? The eggs don't just sit there, they need to move.
Absolutely. But isn't it amazing? Isn't nature amazing how that motherboard knows exactly what to do, when to turn them and when to bring the ones from the bottom up to the top to know exactly what temperature to keep them at? I found that incredible because when you're doing, you have to have a thermometer in the incubator so that you can keep an eye on the temperature. You have to watch the humidity that's present inside the incubator. You have to turn the eggs. You have to move them from the centre to the outside. Like, there is a fair bit about it, but I had a set of instructions. I could follow the instructions. For the mammy birds, it came naturally to her. So it is fairly complex. It's not just a simple thing of sitting on eggs.
Terry, you're here tonight to tell us about some special trees that are in the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin.
Yes, Derek, I was up in the National Botanic Gardens, or as we called them when we were kids, we called them the Bots. And they're one of my all-time favourite spots to visit. And lots of visitors, they like to visit the gardens, particularly those magnificent Turner glass houses, which were recently renovated about 20 years ago, I think. And they'd like to go and see the collections of orchids and cacti and succulents. But the gardens, they also boast a large number of mature trees, which look stunning at this time of the year. And recently, I met up with the director of the gardens, Dr. Matthew Jebb, who then introduced me to some of these interesting specimens.
Now, Terry, this is the first tree I see every morning when I step out of my front door, a giant sequoia, the redwood, the giant redwood from California.
God, so many people would be so envious of you to walk out your front door and then to see that. It's a magnificent tree.
It is a fantastic tree, sequoia dendron, and it is the biggest living thing on this planet, and that makes it very thrilling. People tend to think of, you know, is the blue whale the biggest living thing? No, it's a tree that grows in California.
Mm. Now, as we walk up through the gardens here, the next tree that I see here is a magnificent specimen, and I do believe it's called the Tree of Heaven.
That's right, Ailanthus, which is Latin for heaven. Mm. And it was named really because the early European collectors travelling to Southeast Asia, obviously when they got ashore off their sailing boats, thought, wow, you know, what a big tree climbing up to heaven. So they're not actually the tallest trees around, but their name derives from the fact that they are reaching up to the heavens. So Ailanthus is a tree from Southeast Asia, and it's a fabulous looking beast here. You can see with its huge long leaves. Each leaf is nearly 2.5 feet, 3 foot long.
Yeah, and I believe there are both male and female trees, which is unusual because most trees contain both male and female parts.
That's right. Most of the flowering plants are hermaphrodites, so they have the male and female organs in every flower. But there are always exceptions, and there are a number of plants, especially amongst the conifers, where we have separate males and females. And it becomes very interesting then, because if you only have a few individuals around, it can make breeding very risky in that you might all be male or all be female. So being hermaphrodites has been of huge benefit in the evolution of flowering plants.
Is this tree common in Ireland?
Not at all, no. It's an unusual thing. So we have a number of different species of Tree of Heaven here. But there's a slightly sinister side to them, which is that they are already banned for sale in France because they have proved overly invasive. So they've been introduced to our gardens for the last 1.5 centuries, but now climate change has meant that they are suddenly producing seeds, fruits, and in the south of France they are spreading horrendously.
So in Ireland then you would hope that it doesn't spread?
We will keep a very close eye on it. This individual here right next to us began flowering and fruiting only about 10 years ago. Prior to that we hadn't really noticed it as something producing either flowers or fruits, but now every autumn a huge crop of seeds drop and we are watching carefully, are any of them germinating? They may not actually have, you know, fertile seed. And that's something that we need to test. But we need to be wary in all our plant growing activities into the future to be aware of a future Japanese knotweed.
But you can't get away from the fact that it's an absolutely beautiful tree. It's stunning. It's got this kind of multi-stem. It's got this rounded crown on it. And it's just outside the glasshouses.
Yes, and it's the lack of twigs and branches on it. Because the leaves are so enormously long with lots of leaflets on them, it means the tree structurally looks very light and airy, even though it's got a big dense canopy, just because each individual leaf is actually gigantic in length.
Mm-hmm. Now, most people would turn right now and they'd go into the greenhouses, but we're going to head on straight because the next tree that I see here is a tree that you told me about a number of years ago. It's a very special tree too. It's the strawberry tree.
That's right, the arbutus. What is intriguing about arbutus is it is found in the west of Ireland, from Kerry and Cork all the way up to County Sligo. This tree is found in the oak forests of the west of Ireland. And it has been, you know, speculated upon for centuries as to why is a tree that's more characteristic of the Mediterranean maquis vegetation, this dry, scrubby vegetation around the Mediterranean, also so happy in the Killarney oak forests. Mm.
It's got a beautiful stem. That's what I think attracts most people to it. It's got that, I suppose, strawberry-coloured stem.
Yes, although the strawberry is literally the appearance of its fruits, but they don't taste as good. So one of the amusing ideas of its name, Arbutus unado, is that it is derived from the expression eat one, that you would only eat one to realise it wasn't a proper strawberry, it was a little insipid. But the bark, you're right, is, especially of the hybrid, there's a hybrid with a species from the east of the Mediterranean, Andrachne, and that has got beautiful stipple bark, and that's the individual that we're looking at here, the hybrid strawberry tree.
And this particular tree was planted by none other than
our president, President Michael D. Higgins, and it was during the period when he was the Minister of Arts, Culture and the Gaeltacht, and the Botanic Gardens fell under his remit way back in 1995. And to celebrate the completion of the restoration of the Curvilinear range here, he planted this, what was then a tiny little tree, and has now become a magnificent and beautiful addition to the garden.
Now, it's not as tall as the Tree of Heaven beside it, but there's something really very special about it. To me, it's the trunk.
Yes, the bark is particularly beautiful. It peels, it's got red, it's just multicoloured. Reds, oranges, pinks, sort of every possible red you can think of is present in the bark of this tree. And interestingly, in the middle of summer, this tree has got no flowers or fruit on it because this group of strawberry trees, they all flower in the middle of the winter. So they bloom in the middle of the winter, and actually their fruits take the entire 12 months to ripen. So it bears ripe fruits in December, January.
Now, there's one other tree I want to see. I'm not quite sure where it is in the gardens, but it's the Judas tree. Can we go there?
We certainly can. It's not far beyond us. And here, Terry, here is the Judas tree. It's a very large shrub more than anything else, but it's got these beautiful heart-shaped leaves. Yeah. And it's a plant, again, found in the East Mediterranean and much of Asia Minor.
Hmm. Now, it has beautiful flowers in springtime, I believe.
Yes, it's covered in these purpley red flowers, which are arising almost straight out of the branches. So it does take on a very peculiar look, this deep red colour along its branches.
So the flowers are actually on the stem and on the branches, not necessarily high up in the canopy.
Exactly. It's a tree that bears its flowers cauliferously. So we call it a stem flowering tree.
And I presume that's to help with pollination with the likes of mammals, say.
Probably the most important thing is for the pods and fruits to be well hidden by the canopy. Any fruiting tree runs a strange twofold risk. It wants that fruit to be spread by a disperser, but it also wants to hide it from other animals that might want to eat the fruits. So it's hard to know why it has evolved in this way, but it has evolved to keep its little pods, because it's a member of the pea family, hidden inside the canopy and against the tree trunk.
So because it's in the pea family, does that mean then it has colonies of bacteria living within it?
It does. It has these root nodules, and it is one of the reasons that wherever we go into arid or very poor soils, we'll often find a huge number of legumes growing there, especially trees. So throughout North Africa, the Eastern Mediterranean, there are lots of leguminous trees and shrubs growing in very poor soils, and they are fixing their own nitrogen.
Which makes it very beneficial to the plant to be able to live in an area that's deficient in nitrogen.
And the other great feature of these legumes is, you know, we know they're protein rich, and that again is their huge quantity of nitrogen that they are fixing into their roots, however poor the soil is, and they're able therefore to produce very sort of protein rich seeds.
Now, the unusual thing about this tree is that we're led to believe, how true I don't know, maybe you will tell me, that this is the tree, the Judas tree, that Judas hung himself on after he betrayed Jesus.
Exactly. There are many theories as to why it got its name. And sometimes we can go through the literature and try to understand why did the botanist who gave a scientific name to something pick on that particular name? Or why did a folklore put a name on a tree? So, you know, we can look around at trees like oak and ash, and actually these are Danish words, and they're probably Viking names that arrived here. But the Judas tree, there are numerous stories about whether it was the tree on which Judas hung himself, having betrayed Christ, or it's the red colour of the flowers against the trunk, or did it come from Judea, the region in which it grows?
Yes, I've read that as well, that it's nothing to do with Judas,
yeah,
but from the region Judea, which is now Israel.
And another great tree is the cedar of Lebanon, which, yes, it grows in the hills of Lebanon there, but, you know, there's another cedar, the deodar cedar from northern India, from the Himalaya range, and that is Deodara, which is the tree of God, God's tree. So the way we acquire names or put names on plants is very interesting, the whole etymology of it. Often, you know, it's a Pandora's box that we open when we try and find out why did something get named that.
That's why taxonomy is really such an important science.
It is, because what we do in the form of botanical nomenclature, at least, is we have a very strict set of rules as to when a name has been officially given to a species of plant and how it's constructed.
And the important thing there is that once this name is given, it's given in Latin, it's got two words, but also
it's common throughout the world. So that everyone, whether you're a scientist in Ireland or England or Israel or wherever it is, we all know what that plant is.
A great example is the bluebell. Mm. You know, the bluebell of a South African is a climber called Solia, or it's a little plant called Wallenbergia. The bluebell of New Zealand is a completely different plant, a Mertensia. And the bluebell of Scotland is the harebell.
Yeah.
So bluebell is a useless word to use when you're speaking in the English language. And therefore, we have to have a scientific name for the Hyacinthoides non-scripta, which is what we think of as the little bluebell.
But these names have gotten plants into trouble. And only very recently, in a conference in Madrid, there was a motion to change some of the names of these plants. Why?
Every 6 years or so, a meeting of the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature takes place, where the adjustment of rules or novel rules can be introduced. And at the last conference, two proposals were put forwards, one of which was to ban the use of naming trees after people, or when I say trees, all plants, that any plant, a new plant coming up, would not be given the name of a person, because there are risks involved. People that we realise were slave traders of the past have many plants named after them, and you say, gosh, that's very unfortunate and sort of unpleasant in a way. Can we just change that and correct all those names? Well, then you enter a problem where all of the literature contains a name like Hibbertia, and then we now realise that Mr. Hibbert was not a nice person, and should we change it? Or do we lose the integrity of all that literature of plant names? A second proposal was put forward to specifically ban the use of the word Kaffra. So a huge number of South African plants, in fact it's about 200 different species, were given the epithet, which is the second part of the name, Kaffra, which derives from an Arabic name, essentially meaning infidel. But it became a pejorative term through colonial periods. The word Kaffir became a very unpleasant and abusive term. So the proposal has been put forward to clean up the floras, if you like, of South Africa, to remove that name with a very simple orthographic alteration, i.e. a change in spelling, which is to knock off the initial C and turn it into Afra, essentially deriving from the word Africa. So suddenly these 200 plants can be thought of as no longer being having the name Kaffra, but Afra. And this will make it much easier and more pleasing for everybody in that part of Africa to be able to read these floras without seeing a nasty reference to the past.
Well, that's fine for the plants, but I don't think the zoologists are following in your footsteps. I can think of two insects, one a beetle called after Adolf Hitler, and there's another one, a moth called after Mussolini, and I'm sure there are many, many others, but the zoologists, they're not wanting to change.
They have their own set of rules. So the botanists have one set of rules, which covers actually fungi as well. So plants and fungi covered by one code, and then the other code covers that for animal names throughout the world. So there are distinct differences between our rules. They evolve as we also evolve sort of socially. And no, I think there's an appreciation for the same reason that the proposal to ban the use of inappropriate uses of people's names, that was turned down. Most of the botanists agreed this is going to be too destabilizing. The whole point of this set of rules is to create stability. And one of the most important rules we have is priority. The very first name that was applied to that plant should be the correct official name for it. And the other names we regard as a sort of junior synonyms. They fall under it. They're like extra nicknames for it, but we don't recognise them as having official status.
So whatever way we look at it, we may be moving slowly, but at least we're moving in the right direction.
correct. It's a matter of looking at it in a holistic way, but that we all sit down and we say, okay, we will change this rule as long as it doesn't destabilize things. So this decision to rename all these plants as having the name Afra in them is something that most people agreed. That's a very clear, simple alteration that will make future floras a more pleasing read for everybody.
Lovely stuff. Thank you very much indeed, Terence Flanagan.
You're very welcome.
All right, we'll catch up with Terry again next Monday. Now, in December of 2023, that's last December, the IUCN, that's the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, redesignated Atlantic salmon from least concern to endangered in the UK and near threatened in other parts of its range, including Ireland. Well, as you probably know, we have all sorts of experts on this programme, and one of them just happens to be a fisheries scientist by the name of Dr. Ken Whelan. And he sat down with myself and Dr. Richard Collins to explain the background to the story.
Yeah, it's a very worrying situation. It started really, I suppose, our today's story started last December. And there's a group called the IUCN, which is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And they're the body that are actually responsible for putting these designations in place. So when you hear about the white rhino, that has the classification of endangered. And you have other creatures then would be classified as near endangered. It's IUCN that actually take in the information and make those decisions. And in December last year, it really surprised us that the IUCN decided that the Atlantic salmon in the UK was endangered. We were really surprised at this. Not alone was the salmon in the UK endangered, but the Atlantic salmon throughout the rest of its range was redesignated as nearly threatened from a situation where it was of least concern was the designation it had before that. So certainly that was a real red flag that something was happening and something really serious was happening. And lo and behold, over the last few weeks, Norway has taken the unprecedented step of closing down over 30 of its major salmon rivers, which at this time of the year would be bringing in very large income to the people who own the rod fishing in Norway. And again, that's a very clear sign that we have a serious issue with our Atlantic salmon. The issue really, I think, is down to a combination of two things. Certainly, we have a major issue in terms of the survival of the fish at sea, and we've a really good index on this. So when the young salmon go out, we've several places around the North Atlantic that actually count the number of baby salmon that are going out to sea, and they count all of the adults that are coming back in. And say 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if you had 100 baby salmon going to sea, you could confidently expect that you'd have between 10 and 25 of them coming back as salmon. We now have as few as 5 and at times only 3 coming back from those 100 babies that go out. So there's obviously a very significant and serious issue at sea. In addition to that, we have a lot of problems in freshwater. And really, it's a combination of problems such as fish passage, where we have barriers in freshwater. We have problems, as we know, in terms of our water quality. We have problems in terms of drainage of our rivers. So all of these things are adding to the overall problem. So it's a combination of freshwater and marine. But we're certainly in a situation now where our salmon are under increasing pressure.
Are they dying at sea? Is something eating them?
This is the big question. So quite a number of different groups have been working on this now. We had a big programme that I spoke about here on the radio about 15 years ago now, called SALSEA, or the Salmon at Sea programme. And for the first time, we managed to actually get some ships from the Marine Institute in Ireland included. And having got this gift of the ships, we were actually able to follow these fish to sea for the very first time. And since then, we've been able to identify a few factors. We now have quite a good map of what we call the salmon highway. So this is only for the fish that are in Britain and Ireland and France and Spain, any of the southern stocks. But this highway goes right along the west coast of Ireland, right along the continental shelf and up to Norway. And that's the very first pathway that these little baby salmon follow when they go to sea. And we have evidence at this stage, and increasing evidence, that that first summer at sea seems to be where the problem is arising. And that's really what we're concerned about at the moment. What is causing these fish to die off? Could it be something, as you say, is eating them? Could it be that they have a disease? Could it be that they can't find enough food? So up to now, we really weren't sure what was happening.
Get the lead out, Ken, will you? Richard.
When you use the expression, you fisheries people, aggregations of post smolts along the continental shelf of Ireland, Scotland and Norway, that's an actual quotation from a recent paper. Do you mean that the smolts go out and they gather together and they have a kind of holiday off the west of Ireland and then move on to Scotland to have another holiday there and then move on to Norway? Or do they go on to a motorway? And is it a continuous movement all the way up, or do we know?
I think we do know, actually, which is very interesting. So the most important thing to think about is what we scientists called energetics. A little fish goes to sea, as our baby salmon do, at maybe 12 centimetres. About a year later, we're expecting them fish to come back and they need to be between 55 and 60 centimetres. So if those fish are growing that much in 12 months, they really can't be using a huge amount of energy. They really have to be gaining energy for most of the trip. And that gives us the clue as to what is happening. So once these fish get into these big currents that are actually moving north and northeast up towards what we now know to be their first feeding ground off the northwest coast of Norway, they're actually within that motorway, but it's a moving motorway. And they can feed within the motorway, but if they're in the right position, they don't necessarily have to swim against any huge currents. They can actually use the currents to get to the spot where they're heading for.
Well, is the food supply along the motorway adequate? Are there enough way stations along the way, petrol stations where you could pull off and have a snack? Or is it poverty, famine all the way up?
Well, we now have at least the beginning, the glimmer of an answer to that. Because some colleagues of mine that work for the Missing Salmon Alliance, and as you know, I'm associated with the Atlantic Salmon Trust, and we're a member of this Missing Salmon Alliance. Some of the young and very brilliant scientists that we have in that group have just last week published this amazing paper. So these questions are obviously very, very difficult to answer. We're not out there. We're not actually seeing what these fish are feeding on. We're not seeing what is actually feeding on these fish. But because of what Sir Alistair Hardy did in the 1920s, we're actually now able to use an index that's giving us some bit of an answer to the question you've just posed. So the Sir Alistair Hardy Foundation and what's called the continuous plankton record, which stretches back to 1931, 9 decades of information on these tiny little creatures, these little crustacea called plankton that are in the ocean. And because of the data that we have from this continuous record, and because of the fact that these little plankton feed the actual fish larvae that our salmon feed on, these clever scientists have managed to come up with an index where they can actually show that because of the changes in the ocean since the 1960s, the actual abundance of these little creatures that are feeding or potentially should be feeding these little larvae that our salmon will feed on when they go to sea, that has never been lower in terms of its energy content. So that's really, really, really very worrying. And certainly some of the language that's used in the paper talking about dramatic declines. These are not usually words that scientists would use. So it's very substantial in terms of the change that's actually taking place off our west coast.
Well, now you're saying that the food has declined. Is it that the oxygen has declined because the sea is getting warmer and the water can't support as much oxygen as it used to be able to support in the same areas? And is this a displacement pushing further north into cooler waters?
These are things, again, that will have to be looked at into the future. Now, I should say that, and they're very clear about this in the paper, what they have at the moment is correlations. And scientists will always tell you that correlation is not causation. But at the same time, this to me is a smoking gun. And what we have known from our SALSI program and from work since then, we have seen a situation where the waters around our west coast in Ireland, we're in a fantastic position to be able to monitor this. But the west coast of Ireland, the west coast of Scotland, we know that there are very significant changes in terms of temperature profiles. And certainly the marine heat wave that we had in Ireland last year was quite amazing, where the temperatures of our seas along the south coast and particularly off Donegal were hugely increased during the summer. So that means that the plankton that would be happily living in warm, basking in warm waters further south, have an opportunity to move north. And perhaps our other planktonic species that normally would live in our average temperature seas around Ireland, they're moving north as well. So it may be that we're seeing an exchange in terms of plankton types. And some of these plankton may be the wrong size. They may be not as nutritious as the original plankton. These are all questions that now have to be looked into. But the fact that the energy levels have so significantly dropped in overall terms since the 1960s is really worrying.
So what you describe implies that it's not that they are heading for extinction, it is that they are moving northwards. It is the habitat is degraded down here now, but the habitat up at northern Norway and off Russia is probably still pristine. So the population of sand eels and sprat and these copepods and so on, they're all moving north, and so likewise are the salmon after it. And they won't become extinct on that model. They will simply be elsewhere. And if you want to see them in 50 years' time, you'll have to go to, what, the Kara Sea or the Ob River or someplace like that in northern Russia.
So we were very comfortable, and I think we discussed that, you and I, on the programme years ago, and I think I made those very points. Except, what have we seen now? We have seen the closure of rivers in Norway, the very place that I would have thought would have been at one of the remaining strongholds. And that's very worrying. The fact that they have closed their rivers, and again, we don't know why. We just know that the numbers coming back have been particularly low this year. But the fish that we're talking about in Norway, quite different to our own salmon. So salmon have a choice when they go to sea. They can come back after a year, as most of our salmon do, and they're about maybe, you know, between 4 and 6 pounds weight. Or they can stay at sea for 2 or perhaps even 3 years. And it's the 3 sea winter fish that seem to have disappeared in Norway. And that really is very worrying indeed, because that is one of the areas, as I say, that we would have thought would have been a remaining stronghold for quite a long time to come.
There was a factor you mentioned last time, and that was distance. You were saying that a smolt leaving a river down here had a very long way to swim up to off Greenland or Iceland or somewhere or northern Norway. I would have thought that the Norwegian ones would still be at a very great advantage because it's on their doorstep. They don't have so far to go. But now you tell me that the Norwegian ones, they are declining as well, and that is very ominous. They haven't a huge journey to make.
Well, the strange thing is that we don't actually know where the Russian and the Norwegian post-smolts go, not to any great extent. At least we have the beginnings of a map of our smolt highway, which, as I say, is great news for Ireland and for the UK and France and Spain. But with all the research that's been done, we don't have a lot of information about where the Norwegian and Russian salmon go. Interestingly, it's the southern rivers in Norway are the rivers that have been closed. So again, this is fascinating because this is real detective work. This will have to be looked into. Where exactly, as you say, these fish go? What's happening to the oceans in those particular areas? But I think the one thing that's coming across very clearly in all of our discussions at the moment in terms of our Atlantic salmon is that we definitely have a crisis. And the other thing is it is moving much faster than we would have thought. And we do not have time to sit around. So we really do have to try and take action to make sure that we are conserving as well as we can all of our very valuable populations of Atlantic salmon.
Dr. Ken Whelan, you can find out more details by visiting the website rte.ie/Mooney. Just a reminder before we go, next Monday afternoon right here on RTE Radio 1, Niall Hatch presents a wonderful documentary about birds' eggs.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I'd go with chicken.
Why?
Because the egg had to come from somewhere, so it came from the chicken.
It had to be the chicken, yeah.
Why?
Because you couldn't get an egg without a chicken.
But you couldn't get a chicken without an egg, but you couldn't get an egg without a chicken.
This holiday Monday, ornithologist Niall Hatch explores the wonderful world of birds' eggs.
There must be two chickens.
The secret behind the shell of a bird's egg is that it's full of tiny holes, which allow the developing chick within to breathe oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide.
That's Nature on One, Monday at 3 o'clock on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio app.
That's all we have time for tonight. My thanks to Niall Hatch and Terry Flanagan, Dr. Richard Collins and Dr. Ken Whelan. Visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Our broadcast coordinator is Daniel Keating. See you next week. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.